Today, I'm privileged to be speaking with Emily A. Francis. Emily is the author of the book, The Body Heals Itself, and her website is emilyafrancisbooks.com. She's worked in corporate wellness and also as an aerobic director, kickboxing instructor, and yoga teacher. She's a clinical massage therapist and has a lot of training in these techniques, is the author of Stretch Therapy, and also holds gold medal in the U.S. Open in Tai Chi, as well as a bachelor's degree in exercise science. Emily, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
What I so like about your work is that you have such an acute awareness of the link between emotional, mental, and physical well-being, and you emphasize this in everything you do. How did you come to that understanding?
14 years ago, I was in massage school, and the teacher made a quick mention that the psoas, which is a hip flexor, your primary hip flexor, and the longus coli, which is a muscle deep in the front of the throat, are your two most emotional muscles. And it struck such a chord with me that I stayed after class, and I asked him, where's the book? I want to read everything I can on this information. How do you know this? And he basically dismissed it as something that has been passed down through the generations of body workers, but with there's no book on it and there's no research really behind it. And as I got out into the professional world, I specialize in manual lymphatic drainage, so I work with people post-cancer and post-surgery, as well as doing the clinical sports massage. And I found that that having a deeper understanding of the emotional component that the muscles hold honestly changes everything about healing. And so I started to basically create my hypothesis and make notes and start to test it with different people and then talk to different professionals in the various healing fields. And it turns out that the stuff I was coming up with, other people knew as well. And so I just started building that and putting that together. But to watch people have a really sincere emotional release that leads the way to profound healing in the body made me realize that if you can basically communicate with the body and help it to set itself, reset itself, huge opportunities happen within the body.
So give us an example, a dramatic example of a person who did this and saw those kinds of shifts.
Okay, this is my most dramatic example that I have, and I did not put it in the book, but I was referred by a person through their oncologist. They had stage 1 ovarian cancer, and their body, there was only one particular type of chemotherapy that would save them, and their body rejected the chemotherapy. And so the oncologist said, okay, there's a person in town, I don't know what she does, but go see her and see if she can somehow get your body to take this chemo so we can save your life. And so she called me up and said, my oncologist referred me, and can you see me? And I said, clear your schedule. And we had a couple of hours of really serious, you know, hysterical crying, depth of your secrets and things that you've kept in for so long. I literally pulled a trash can next to the table in case she needed to vomit, which she did. but it was just so intense.
Wow.
And the release
wow.
was so huge. But she went back to the doctor the following week, and her body took the chemo, and she's 8 years remission. Now, that's not me. I just happened to be the middleman. I got to witness the miracle. But her body, from releasing its deep-held secrets in that body, in the muscles and in the organs and in the energy body, changed everything about her life. And she's 8 years out. And that was her body healing itself once it had permission to do so.
You know, I'll tell you a story that I heard from a psychotherapist friend of mine, and Emily, she first became aware of the difference of the connection between these domains in our lives when she was a body worker as well. She was doing body work on a female client, and when she touched a certain spot in this woman's legs, this woman's body began to heave with uncontrollable sobs, and she remembered a memory of when she was 8 years old and her father had committed suicide. And she had stuffed these terrible images and memories into her muscles for all those years. And then finally, during that massage session, when she had her legs worked on, suddenly that triggered the recall the memory and a catharsis that allowed it to release. So that was the most dramatic example I heard, maybe 20 years ago, from somebody who was both working both ends of the spectrum, mind and body. And
body.
I mean, yeah, these stories are amazing.
And they're real. I mean, and it's really that once your body really is granted permission to heal itself, it will do the work itself. And that's why we titled it "The Body Heals Itself," because you're never the healer. I think, and it's really difficult for me if people say, "Oh, I'm a healer." No, you're not. You're a helper. You're an unconditional, open, loving channel, a conduit, you know, from spirit to a person's body. But you yourself are not doing the healing. The body has to agree, and has to agree on a cellular level. Every part of the body, the thoughts, the cells, everything has to get onto one same team and agree that, yes, here on this planet Earth is where I'm going to heal. Because not all healing happens here. That's why I mentioned that the body can be cured and the spirit can be healed.
So here is one question that I still don't really know the answer to, and I've been studying these things for 40 years or more, and I just I don't have a really good answer for this yet. Like, for example, we may do acupuncture with somebody, and then the acupuncturist works at a certain particular acupuncture point, and suddenly there's a huge release and healing begins to happen. Or in psychotherapy, so when I go for psychotherapy with many different therapists and not really make much progress, then there's some kind of node that's triggered in the psyche, and suddenly the person heals. Because, as you're saying, we have this healing potential, we have these healing abilities innately within us anyway, what can block them? What is it that prevents them from just healing us naturally? And why can those blockages remain in place for so many years?
That's a huge question, and I'm not sure that I can also do it justice, but I have a couple of different reasons. I mean, there's a reason that certain people can get a response out of you, and I believe that the body locks in. Because so the mind experiences a trauma, and you deal with what you can deal with. And then you stuff everything else away, and it's hidden in your body. And you don't go looking for it because you don't even know that that's happening. And so it's in these little random pockets in your body. And the muscles hang on tight for dear life for this situation. Because think that muscles have muscle memory. It's not just about swinging a bat and a ball. It's about locking in everything that's ever happened to it, good and bad. And I do believe that different people can somehow unlock a part of your understanding that allows you to let your body heal itself. So it might be that it's the acupuncturist, or you might go to 10 different acupuncturists, but one somehow can discuss with your body something that maybe you haven't done before. Or, like, I mean, I've gone to a lot of acupuncturists, but there was a particular time where they added electrodes onto the needles, and I had this huge healing experience. And they didn't talk me through anything. It was a meditation that happened alone in the room, but huge things happened. And I believe that there are different people that can help your body to understand itself in a different level. So that might be from cognitive therapy or psychotherapy. It might be from hands-on healing. It might be from needles or, you know, various different things. But I do believe that different people can communicate with your body differently. And whoever it is that helps your body to understand the issues can help it unlock. So I don't think it's always just by yourself. I do think that the other person that helps can be incredibly instrumental, and they might have an answer. It's almost like you're a remote control. I mean, I've started to learn this from watching a lot of work on people's brains lately. It's like there's a remote in there, but nobody knows how to actually use the remote, and then somebody comes along and knows exactly where the pause button is or the play button or the rewind, and they can somehow help you program into a different existence. And it's just, and there's no rhyme or reason to it. And the reason you haven't been able to come up with a succinct answer on that is because there's no rhyme or reason. You're just led to the right people when it's the time to really get out of your own way and allow the healing to happen. Does that make sense?
That's also why it's important to take advantage of a range of healing opportunities. For some people, acupuncture might be perfect. For other people, EFT might do it, or EMDR. For some people, psychotherapy is the leverage point, and so it takes some shopping around sometimes to find the right person and where who's able to hit that button on the remote. And one person might be able to do it for one client, but not for, for another. And, and then, yeah, so you just need to look around and see what seems right, feels right, and helps you shift. I think that's really really worth emphasizing, because there is no one-size-fits-all healing.
There's never a one-size-fits-all in healing. And honestly, I always tell my clients, I should not be your only massage therapist. I should not be your only Reiki person. I shouldn't, you know, because sometimes we're going to click and lock, and sometimes somebody else can do something. There's always somebody that knows something else and something more. And so you do. I always encourage people to go wide in their search. So if acupuncture didn't work the one time, try it with somebody else, because different hands and different understanding do different things. Even if you're doing the same method of treatment, it's not the same.
Yes. And again, even in acupuncture, there is something called the acupuncture clock. And in traditional Chinese medicine, you weren't just getting a needle at a certain point in your body. You were getting a needle at a certain time of day. And so some things might even work at certain times and not work at other times. I know you're also into Tai Chi, and I don't have a regular Tai Chi practice, but I do whenever I can. I teach at Omega and Kripalu and Esalen and other places where I meet other teachers, and I always, if I can take a Tai Chi class with a guy like Roger Jahnke, who's one of the sort of grand old men in Tai Chi in the U.S., I'll do it. Or Chun Yi Lin, I'll be seeing Chun Yi, wonderful Qigong teacher called Chun Yi Lin next month. And so I love I feel so good in those classes. And I'm amazed that these forms of movement are thousands and thousands and thousands of years old, and yet they're so potent. Tell us more about them.
Well, Tai Chi is actually the most deceptive form of martial arts, and I love that part, that it's very deceptive how all these slow movements make it very easy to do it fast. But doing it slow, you're really rooting deeply into the earth, and you're letting the energy move you. So if you are regularly standing and holding your arms feel like they weigh 50 pounds. But if you let the energy lead and using the earth energy up through your body and then coming out of the limbs, your arms feel weightless. And I always found that just so fascinating. And I don't practice the way that I used to. I used to practice really 3 to 5 days a week for several hours a day, and we would go to the park, and it was beautiful. And my teacher stopped teaching, and it's been very hard to find a teacher that I've really stuck with since. So at this point, I just do a lot by myself and in very small increments, which kind of makes me sad. But one of the things that I always loved when we were at the park is how different the energy is when you're outside practicing than in any other place. And so we would always find our own trees and stand and do a standing meditation for nearly an hour. And if you're doing it inside, you get bored in like 5 minutes. But if you're outside and you're standing by your tree and the roots and all these magical things happen, and you find that you can stand there for 45 minutes and feel like you lost time, and you just connected with this incredible nature space. But Tai Chi itself is very slow movements. It's incredibly beautiful work, and the energy moves through you. And I one of the things that I loved so much about Tai Chi was it was the first time in my life that people could discuss energy without being judgmental.
Yeah, and also it makes you mindful because you are moving so slowly. I know that many of our lives are lived at a very fast pace. We're on autopilot most of the time. And in fact, big chunks of our brain, the part of our brain called the default mode network, is meant to govern unconscious behavior. And so it was very adaptive for us in evolutionary terms to be on autopilot most of the time, so we could devote our conscious attention to the important stuff like finding opportunities, avoiding threats, and so on. And yet that results in this really fast-paced life in which we miss so many things that are going on. Whereas if you slow down, if you really take time to breathe, get into your body, get conscious, then that slowing down is so useful because it makes the brain pay attention in a way which it doesn't when you stay stuck in that default mode network and you're running on autopilot.
You know, my teacher that I trained with for the longest, that was back when I was in corporate wellness, and I would teach kickboxing, and I hired him to teach Tai Chi at our corporate fitness place. And I started taking Tai Chi and yoga because I was the director and I needed to be able to sub and fill in a class if they were out. It just was so beautiful the way it all lined up. But when I would walk in after teaching kickboxing, I made him crazy. He hated sharing the space with me because my energy was so up there and you know, I just taught kickboxing in 20 years with him. I stopped teaching aerobics and I stopped teaching kickboxing and I just went totally with the martial arts and the yoga only, because he would say, you know, Emily, I don't know why you come back. I don't know why you come back, because it was so out of my, I'm such a high energy person. And then it got to where he really watched the way that I would sit, stand, and walk, and the way that I would breathe, and the way that I would do anything. And he actually wanted me at one point to go live in a mountain for a year and then come back and talk to everybody. He wanted me to go live alone for a year in a mountain. But having a teacher like that, that really watches, I was the only female and I was the only American in this class for a long time. But having somebody that really studies everything that you do and the way that you move and your consciousness, when I started with him, I really virtually had none of those things. And then through having somebody say, okay, let's just look at the way you breathe. Wow. You know, and at the time, my breathing was pretty painful to watch. And then learning how to lower it into that belly and out of the chest and to make those breaths long and meaningful and utilizing those lungs and your diaphragm, and it gives you a new way of life completely. And then you don't realize how much you learn until you watch other people and realize how much more conscious you have spent time becoming. And so now I don't teach kickboxing and I don't teach high energy things. Now I don't teach anything, I just enjoy. but it really was a life changer for me to have a teacher that broke everything into small segments that helped me to change so many things about myself.
I remember being in a Qigong class once on the beach in Cancun, Mexico, with a Qigong master, and it was an hour-long class, and all he had us do for one whole hour, Emily, was one single movement, and my mind was going totally nuts. He was having us sort of gather chi up from the sand, up down the center line of our bodies, and then breathe out at the level of our mouths. And I thought, oh, the first 3 or 4 minutes was cool, slowed me down, felt good. Then it was 10 minutes, then it was 15 minutes. Let's just keep on doing the same. And I was thinking, why is he stuck in the same posture for such a long time? And of course, in our Western world, he wants something to happen next. You'll do this, then you'll do this. After that, you'll do this. And this is the structure of a session. And we're so used to that kind of
time,
a format.
For how long? For how many counts? For how long are we going to do this? What's next? And that attachment to the clock. I actually got rid of a clock in my massage room, which is why I work for myself, because I refuse to go by the clock. Because if we're done, we're done. If we're not, we're not. So I just do a fee for a standing session, which either you love me or you hate it. But usually you get more bang for your buck that way. But I cannot do the clock anymore.
One thing I've been doing is encouraging practitioners to use longer sessions than 1 hour, because again, that acupuncture clock is a 2-hour clock, and so sessions that last longer than an hour usually are much more in tune with the body's rhythms. What's called in psychotherapy the 50-minute hour, where the psychotherapist after 50 minutes is looking at her watch and with the clock and saying, now it's time to wrap this up. Now, the one thing many people struggle with is pain, physical pain. Tell us how that can guide us, how it can teach us, and also how we can release it.
The first thing I have to say about pain is that you have to first examine the first layer. Are you wearing good shoes? Do you have good posture? Are you carrying a purse or a bag on one side only? Is it too heavy? Are you taking care of your body? Are you giving it balance to both sides? That's before you even start to look into the emotions. Because as I write this book about how the muscles hold on to emotions as part of your pain patterns, I don't want to overlook the really basic things. Repetitive habits, not good posture, not releasing things that are bothering you. If you're a person that never discusses things that bother you, it's going to show up in your glutes. They're going to be in your sit area because you sit on those emotions. So while I do believe that there's an emotional component behind all of the muscle patterns that hold pain, I also want to encourage people to look very, very superficially first, you know, about the way that you're carrying your body. And I also believe that sometimes when you're slouching, you are covering up your heart chakra and things like that, but that's going a little bit deeper. Where you carry your pain can tell a lot about what you are holding on to emotionally. So people that carry their pain in that upper shoulder area have a tendency to feel like the weight of the world is on their shoulders. But it's not just that. It's that a lot of those people tend to have type A personalities where they believe that nobody can do the job as well as they can. So it's one of those, I want you to do it, but I'll just do it myself. If I want to get it done right, I have to do it. But that really is sort of a... You're bringing that on yourself. Other people can do a great job at things. They just might not do it exactly the way that you would do it. So figuring out if that's the place that you hold your pain the most, you might want to learn how to delegate some responsibilities and then step back and detach from the way that somebody does something. Pain in the jaws and in the neck, those headaches all the time, usually have to do with the jaws. So if the jaws lock up the back of the neck locks up the jaws. They go together. If you just treat the base of the skull and you're not treating the jaws, chances are that the person isn't going to have a long-lasting relief from their pain. Emotionally, those areas are about not being able to let go of your situation, things that you keep replaying over and over, and you chew on the bone long after that bone should have been thrown out. So any sort of situation that's happened to you that you just really can't make heads or tails out of it, you just keep replaying it, it's going to sit in those jaws, and then it's going to go to the neck, and then you're going to start having headaches, and it's all connected to your thought patterns. Betrayal is behind the shoulder blades, so a lot of people carry pain in that shoulder blade. That's where the knife is. And it could be from 20, 30, 40 years ago, a past life. It can be anything. But it's a traumatic betrayal that sits in those shoulder blades. So once you figure out, okay, my purse isn't too heavy, or I'm not carrying a purse, or I do use good posture and I am taking care of myself, but I can't get rid of this constant pain, that's when you go to the emotion level.
So interesting that you look at those mechanical factors as well and then look at the emotions as the next layer of this. Give us an example of somebody who you worked with who was able to shift their pain by taking a look at those two levels.
I had a woman, I used to work at a premier medical spa, and I had a woman come to me and she said, you know, I have this pain behind my shoulder blade, but I've been to everybody, chiropractor, acupuncture, massage, I've been to everyone, you name it, and nobody can get rid of it. You know, she issues this challenge, and I tear at it like a beast. I am breaking a sweat. I'm pulling everything I've got. And I finally looked at her and I said, I'm sorry, this is not physical. This is emotional. Have you heard of Reiki? Would you mind if I put my hands on you and do some energy work? And she said, I have heard of Reiki, but I've never received it. So she's the only woman in my life that I actually put her in a little bit of a compromising position before I did the energy, whereas usually I have you really relaxed. But I put her hand behind her back. I had already lifted up the shoulder blade and worked with my elbow under that area, but I knew she had to be in sort of a physical compromising position for me to get there. So I had her hand behind her back and put my knee there to keep it steady, and then I put my hands down and started my prayers and asking the energy to flow through me, and she all of a sudden kind of started twitching. You know that when twitching happens, when they start curling their toes, moving their body, you know it's on the hunt. There's an emotional release. There's a little bubble in there of emotions that is trying desperately to get out of there and hide out someplace else, and so I followed it. And I said to her, don't think about it, blurt out what's in your mind. And she said, my high school boyfriend cheated on me with my best friend. And she looked up and she goes, wait a minute, I'm in my 60s. I don't care what my high school boyfriend did. That's so silly. And out of nowhere, we hear this audible pop. And it wasn't a pop. There's not a bone. It wasn't a chiropractic type of thing. It was an actual energy pop, but it was audible. And it was all that old pain literally popped right out of that body. It was like I got to pull the knife out. And it was just her being in this position and me saying, don't judge it, don't think about it, what is it? And it popped right out. And it was just one of those really shocking moments to both of us of, oh my gosh, this is 40-plus years of betrayal that sat in this area for so long, laying dormant but still wreaking havoc, and nobody has ever come into that place and said, tell me about this pain, because this isn't something that in her conscious mind she would think about anymore. And it was really eye-opening to me to watch the way that this thing just, boom, gone, and no more pain. I mean, really, it was completely gone.
Emily, we were talking earlier about how your muscles are your body's emotional storage unit. I love that concept. I know that you came to that concept yourself through your own personal journey. And How do you describe that journey, and what were some of the pivotal moments for you in reaching that understanding?
Well, I learned that from working on other people, to tell you the truth, the way that the muscles hold on to the emotions, because it is amazing when you palpate certain areas of the body, how it will instinctively drive their emotional response. But me personally, I went through a lot of years of anxiety and panic, and I really sat out. I became sort of an observer of my life, and I let a lot of really precious years pass me by. And I treated myself like I was living in a glass house, like I was very fragile, like something happened and I was no longer healthy, except it was all in my mind, and my body carried out the signals too. So then my body started to not process and work at its optimum level because my mind blocked it, and I stopped having trust in my body. So I really had to kind of come back to life, and it was not an easy or short process to do this. I really did sit out and watch everything pass. And then as I started to reclaim my life and come back into my life, all those little health problems went away, and I became one particular body. It, you know, it's all on the same team, the physical body, the emotional body, the spiritual body, the energetic body. We all joined together to get on the same team. As I say in my book, it's almost like a gallery of different people in your head. And if one person swings the other way with their vote, then there's chaos in your body. But if everybody agrees on the same thing, then your mind, your thoughts, your spirit, they all line up together. And then you can become an incredibly powerful force for your own good. But it's a tough place to get to. And your body does tell your story.
Where were you in the lowest point of that dark night of the soul or shadow journey?
Oh, I was so far down I couldn't see up. I mean, I really could not see my way up and out from anything. And I lived in constant fear, constant panic and fear. And each day was such a struggle that I was really borderline agoraphobic. I really didn't like to leave my house. I never felt safe in places. My body was breaking down. My mind was causing the breakdown. I was my own worst enemy. And I perpetuated it day after day with my thoughts, those what-if thoughts, you know, and it was me. I had to go down the rabbit hole and face the shadow side of myself and traumas that I had tucked away that I did not deal with since I was a teenager. And mine's pretty textbook. Mine really stems around losing my dad. I was 13, and he was my closest person. And he died of a heart attack while playing tennis. And even though I was constantly an athlete, when the anxiety came in, all of a sudden I was scared to walk into a gym. So here I had been a gymnast since I was 3, a collegiate cheerleader, a aerobic director, kickboxing instructor, yoga instructor, and all of a sudden I'm terrified to walk into a gym. I don't trust my body anymore. I'm thinking about that he went to go play tennis and he had a heart attack and he never came home. And what do you do with that? But for many years, I just sort of partied my way through and self-medicated. And then when I stopped doing all that and had to really examine, it was a unbelievable, tumultuous time of just constant panic and fear. And I couldn't get out of my own way to pick myself back up. And that was so shocking.
What were some of the tools? I don't know, when you have so many resources, when you are so smart, you think, I'm a really intelligent person, I have all these life skills, why can't I master these problems? It seems baffling and frustrating and just so intensely crazy that with all that knowledge, with all that wisdom, with all that experience, you still can't rescue yourself.
No, I couldn't. And I was going to every therapist you can imagine. I was going to a psychiatrist, a psychologist. I went through EMDR therapy. I went through hypnotherapy. I went to psychics. I went to shamans. And I'm doing yoga, and I'm trying everything in the world. And I'm learning a million things, and I'm trying to apply it. I became such a massive student of my own self. But I will say that what I did have to learn is that your brain and your mind are not the same thing. And your mind is where your thoughts live. And that's the stuff that all those cognitive therapies can help with. But your brain is an organ. And it those chemicals, they matter. And so I was so adamantly opposed to medication that I kept trying everything I could. And I was trying herbs, and I was trying diet, and I was trying meditation, and all these things. But I did finally, after 7 years of work on the anxiety, I did finally take medication. And I didn't need it for that long, but it recreated for my brain for me to come back to life and to remember in my body and in my mind at the same time what it felt like to be fully alive. And I will be forever grateful for finally trying that and realizing that I was really closed-minded. I was so far on the holistic side that I was really judgmental and closed-minded on the physical side, and sometimes you need the help. And it did change my life, and it brought me back to life. So I'm no longer medicated for that, but it did do what it needed to do. And I never took more than a child's dose. But it did help me. It did change everything for me.
I know. I do a lot of training at various teaching centers like Kripalu and Open Center and 1440 Multiversity, Esalen. And one of the things we always do in our trainings is we counsel people who are learning energy techniques. And, of course, the wonderful techniques, they work great. But one of the things we found is there's a shadow side to using them. And that shadow side is that people become so enamored of energy techniques, especially after their initial successes, that they can forget about conventional medicine. And it's so important to look for those possibilities as well as the energy ones. So if you use both, you have the best of both worlds. But I know a lot of people jump in and get so enthusiastic about the energy work, they forget that, oh, it might just be, you know, I need that dose.
Right, I need that. Because you know what I noticed when I was going through the really hard time? As I went to a doctor, and I'm not an asthmatic, but I went to a doctor and I was dealing with a lot of respiratory issues then, and they prescribed me an inhaler. And it was terrifying, and I never used it again. But every doctor saw that on the prescription, and nobody tested me for asthma, and so they kept refilling my prescription. And I finally looked at one doctor, and I said, I'm not an asthmatic. Why do you keep giving me this inhaler? And she said, what, you're not? And I said, no, I'm not. Why does everybody keep prescribing me this inhaler? And she said, well, have you ever been tested for asthma? And I said, no, I haven't. And she goes, well, let's start there. She goes, I apologize. I just saw it on your chart and assumed you were because you've been getting this prescription, and let's test you. And I tested at 99% oxygen, and she was like, oh, my gosh, you're absolutely not asthmatic. But it's amazing how many things my body went through when my mind was at the bottom. And it really does trick your whole body into thinking you're sick.
One of the really scandalous statistics that's been published in the last few months is that in Great Britain, we have the National Health Service. It's a wonderful free National Health Service that treats everyone. But in the last 5 years, the bill for drugs has doubled, and people are being prescribed all kinds of medications. The average senior now is being prescribed 5 medications. That's the average. Some are on 12 or 13 medications, many of which are given to them to counteract the effects of other medications. And so this idea that, you know, people over 65 on average are on 5 medications, it's just, the overprescribing is just crazy.
It's so dangerous. You know, but, you know, I put in my story about finally, and I didn't put it in the book, but I've talked about it many times on finally going to medication because I was so adamantly opposed to it. And sometimes you really do need that help, but you have to go to a doctor that isn't trying to make a lot of money from prescribing and overprescribing. And what I realized for myself in my own journey, it was not the psychiatrist. He was going to prescribe 1 million pills. I finally went to my general practitioner and said, I would like to try a child's dose of this anti-anxiety medicine because I can't function. I mean, I had just given up my whole life, and I had a fabulous life, and I just sort of, it was like taking a seat and just sitting on the curb and saying, you know what, life, keep going, I'm going to be here, I'm going to take a seat. But I took a seat for much longer than I think I was ever meant to take. So I sort of feel like I'm still, even though it's been many years now, I feel like I'm still playing catch up with my life and my destiny, because I let so many things pass me by. And that's part of why I like to talk about healing and be really real with people, is because when you get to a place where you are in a really positive place, you only want to talk about the positive, and there's so many amazing opportunities for you to heal. But you have to be honest that the darkness, you have to go there.
You have to go there, and you have to acknowledge the shadow as well as move it toward the light. Emily, in The Body Heals Itself, you talk about the idea of connecting who you were before the trauma or the disease occurred with who you are now and who you're becoming in the future. I love that concept, and go ahead and elaborate on that for us.
I think it's really important that we take ourselves back to the who that you were before that trauma ever existed. But you have to learn how to bridge and merge with who you are now. And that does not, I think a lot of times we almost encourage you to forget or forgive and put it behind you, something that's really been life-altering, but you can't, not in order to heal. So what I encourage you to do is go back to the person that you were before this occurred, and then go and then be present to the person that you are with that trauma in your life. But now you integrate it in such a way that the trauma existed, but it doesn't have the same hold on you anymore. It's part of your story, and you accept it as it was, but now you merge yourself with who you were and with who you are trying to become. Because who you are trying to become is the really important key. But who you were and who you are currently and then where you're going, that three as an integration can empower you in a place that so many times we try to bury that pain. But don't bury it. Face it. Feel it again. Remove it so that you're more of a witness to it. Accept it as it was. And then connect yourself with that brilliant little boy or girl that existed before that thing happened in your life, and now with who you are and where you're going to go. Because where you're going to go is really strong and powerful if you set the intention to go there. But don't bury that stuff in the back. You know, I mentioned my anxiety and panic. I used to be embarrassed about it, and I used to try to hide it. But it is a very significant part of my story that I no longer hide from, because it took that darkness for me to claw my way back up and out and create an entirely new existence for myself that happens to feel really great, and I'm not sick all the time anymore.
Yeah, that ability to connect the past, present, and future is very, very powerful. In Gestalt therapy, Fritz Perls, the founder of Gestalt therapy in the 50s, had this really strong practice of having people think about who they were before the bad stuff happened. When I work with people who are overweight, for example, there'll be a woman in front of me who weighs, say, 350 pounds, and you know, she has a huge amount of weight to lose, and she has arthritis, she's diabetic, she has all kinds of issues, and I'll have this vision in my mind's eye, Emily, of her when she was 3 and 4 and 5, or I'll watch 3-year-olds playing, running around in the park, and they are full of energy. They are just exploring their bodies, inhabiting their bodies. And I think, you know, what happened between 3 and 4 and 5 and 15, 25, 35 to shift that person into that place where they can't move, they're stiff in their body, they're constricted, they think that's them. And it's such a tragedy if that's all they ever know. But if they can then connect to some positive vision for their future, and then see where they are now as a point on a continuum of healing. And the continuum is just one. Where they are now is one spot on that whole timeline. Then that both connects them with the health they once knew and the health they can know in the future.
That's where the magic, the real magic, sits in the body, because a lot of times people think about just the trauma in your muscles, and we got to pull out, we got to help you heal all the trauma. But where does the good stuff go for your healing?
Right.
And that's in your muscles too, because of muscle memory. Muscle memory remembers when you were at your height of health. Muscle memory remembers what was happening in your life. A lot of times people were in their height of health when they were in high school, per se, because they were on a sports team and they loved it. So what happens to you when you go back and you try to do some of that exercise, and you bring your mind in by doing some of the songs that bring you back to that time, or practices that bring you back to that time, and you can pull from the same memory bank that I'm asking you to pull from your trauma, you can pull from the same muscle memory bank your joy. And so there's a lot of things like putting on music that you used to dance around to. And a lot of times we can get back to feeling good and healthy, not by putting so much pressure on ourselves. You should go run a mile. You should go run 10 miles. You need to sign up for a marathon. You should go, you know, all these really serious expectations. But instead, start with one song and dance in your kitchen. Just dance. Just get your body to move. Go play. You know, I even put in my book, put that song, The Warrior, you know, bang, bang, I'm the warrior, because it makes you feel so powerful, and it makes you want to shake a little bit. Or a lot of people like that song, I Will Survive, and you just dance around, but let your body move so that you can pull from the memory bank your happy place without putting all that pressure on yourself. Go work out for an hour. Who says? Who says that 7 minutes isn't a great workout today? Who says that you can't do 2 songs next week? You know, you start small. You start with where you are. But pull that joy and remembrance out of those muscles so that your body can go, oh, my gosh, I used to love to dance. Oh, my gosh, I loved playing soccer. Oh, there's an adult soccer team here? I might join. First, I'm going to start with this little day by day and work with myself and become my own best cheerleader, my best friend, and my best supporter. Because we beat ourselves up, but we can also be the ones to really cheer ourselves on, because we're the only people that know the effort it took.
we are, and there are those competing voices in our head, the self-critical ones and the ones that are cheering us on, and to learn to both quiet the ones that are critical and saying, oh, it's hopeless, I just won't go and eat another donut, and the ones that say, I remember being on the youth soccer team, I'm going to just dance that one song. Letting go of those critical voices and then encouraging those positive ones is powerful practice. How do you then lock those practices into your psyche and your body?
You lay down afterwards and you let it absorb into the muscles. You know, the yogis have it right by doing Shavasana at the end of practice, where you lay down for 5 minutes so that your muscles can remember and retain. Let those good experiences be absorbed into your body. Why do we close our eyes when we feel something really great or when we're looking up at the sun, not just because of the sun? It's also because we're trying to lock it into our muscles. We've forgotten what our bodies are to our minds. But as a unit, close those eyes, lay down, be still, feel that happiness that you just experienced. Talk to your muscles. Talk to your body. And be reminded what joy feels like. And then pull from those muscle banks every day, just a little bit, as you build and rebuild.
So once you're locking that experience into your muscles by being quiet, laying down, absorbing the experience, really relishing the experience, really immersing yourself in the memory of the experience, that then cements that into your muscles so you can retrieve it later on?
Yes.
Hmm.
You know, I remember being a gymnast and learning a skill that I was terrified to learn, and I always had to learn by fear. So the coach would always have to come up and throw me over, and then I would do it. And I hate that. I really hate that. But I finally did it one time, several times, and the coach looked at me and he goes, what a coincidence. It takes 8 times for your body to remember it, and now you're going to remember, because tomorrow you're going to come back and you're going to do it. And I don't even know if 8 was real. It just might have been that I did 8, so he was trying to give me that confidence. But it locked into my mind, and I was 10 years old at the time, and I still think about that and go, if I just do it 8 times, my body will remember, and I'll love it. But the truth is, it's not a particular number. It's really just letting your body remember, and it's trusting that your body knows how to do something.
Yeah, and then as you practice it and practice it over and over and over again, you do develop that muscle memory. And so much of our experience is that routine reenactment of our past. And so to tune into a positive future and then start to walk and move and live as that positive future vision of oneself is so powerful, because you can then replace that existing old sad person with that new positive joyful person.
Because, you know, there's a lot of times where we're our friends' greatest cheerleaders, you know, and we take it down to something small. Look at what you did today. This is so great. I'm so proud of you. You should be very proud of yourself. But why don't we talk to ourselves like that? I mean, I do now. I've learned how to do that. So even this morning, I was supposed to practice yoga with a friend who bailed out at the last minute, and I walked in and I thought, you know what? Your yoga mat's right there. It doesn't matter if she's here or not. Put your keys down. Don't even go upstairs yet. Do your practice. And I didn't do it for that long, but I did what I wanted to do. Myself, huge praise. Look at you. You did your practice this morning. And tomorrow you can do it double. You know, you did everything you needed. It's that taking that time and going step by step and saying, hey, good for you. You did it. You showed up.
And not letting your friends not showing up become your excuse to not show up as well. Say, oh, well, he's not here, I won't do it. Emily, thank you so much for so many inspiring words and concepts, and also just this approach you have of anchoring our emotions in our body and the possibility of anchoring positive ones there for our growth and happiness. I appreciate your approach.
Thank you for having me on. I really love being here.